from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Right now, because of a 1995 law, a big chunk of California's housing stock can't be placed under rent control. Well, that may change this year as a bill to repeal that law is about to get its first public hearing. The issue of rent control has long been a bone of contention between landlord and tenants' rights groups, and this latest effort to increase the number of homes that can be covered by rent control will surely be a bruiser. But could it be the answer to skyrocketing rental prices? We'll talk about it right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're going to be spending this hour talking about a bill that could have major implications for rent control in California. But first, last night, a federal judge here in San Francisco issued an injunction against the Trump administration's decision to wind down the DACA program. We'll be diving into this in depth at 10:30 this morning. But joining me now is California Attorney General Javier Becerra, and he's one of the state attorneys general who filed suit in November saying that the ending of DACA causes irreparable harm to recipients. Good morning, Attorney General.
Michael, good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. This is just a temporary block, and it means a nationwide injunction to keep things in place. Tell us more about it.
It's a great victory. It's a huge first step in this lawsuit to try to prove that the Trump administration violated the law in trying to end the DACA program. And it's another step in proving that the Dreamers really are as American as you and me and belong to this country.
It does require, though, that the Department of Homeland Security will simply keep things in place. Do I have that right?
Which is very important, yes, keep it in place. But that means for many of those young Dreamers who had their DACA status expiring or expired, they can now reapply.
But no new appeals.
Anyone who had not become a DACA recipient before the actions taken by the Trump administration is unfortunately not included here. But anyone who had and had lost their status because their term was expiring can now reapply.
Well, the Trump administration has said they will continue to fight this. In fact, Devin O'Malley from the Justice Department was very specific in saying that you need more. They're going to have more litigation. He referred to illegal aliens in his statement. But here's what President Trump said in a tweet. He said, "It just shows everyone how broken and unfair our court system is when the opposing side in a case such as DACA always runs to the Ninth Circuit and almost always wins before being reversed by higher courts."
Michael, is there anything new in that statement? Isn't that what we've heard Donald Trump say as president, as a political candidate, as businessman? My understanding is there are very few people in America who probably sued or been sued more than Donald Trump. He knows the courts well. He just doesn't know how to move the law in the right direction.
Well, there's also a sense that this maybe should go to Congress. At least that's what we're hearing from the Trump administration. And your thoughts on that?
Without a doubt, we need a permanent solution. We need to give the Dreamers a solution that gives them certainty. We're clearly contesting what the Trump administration did because they did it in an unlawful manner. But we need a permanent solution, and only Congress can give us that.
How do you think this is going to affect essentially what the Trump administration was trying to broker yesterday with a televised meeting for about an hour about immigration in general?
Well, I don't think anyone was able to make sense of where the president was on DACA from that meeting. But what I will tell you is that now that his actions have been stayed by this court, it means that the DACA program will go on beyond March 5th, most likely, which means that those who are resistant to change, the resistant ones to having Dreamers have an opportunity to stay, are now, I think, in a worse position. And I would hope that those who are fighting for the Dreamers understand that the leverage is on their side, and they should not try to cut these deals that would bring baggage that has nothing to do with resolving DACA in any agreement. And it's time to deal with the DACA Dreamers without including this nonsensical border wall and all these bad immigration ideas.
Well, it was set to phase out on March the 5th, but you think this is going to be delayed even more?
there's a very little likelihood that we will have finished the litigation, the lawsuit in court by March the 5th. If the injunction remains in place during the pendency of the trial, March 5th will not be the end of DACA.
Attorney General, I thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Michael.
It's Attorney General Javier Becerra, and a reminder that we'll be doing more DACA coverage and go into this in more in depth at 10:30 this morning. But now we're going to talk about a bill that would repeal California's law limiting rent control. It's getting a public hearing on Thursday, tomorrow, after languishing in committee for nearly a year. In 1995, California lawmakers passed the Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, which exempted certain dwellings from city rent control ordinances. This law has long been a bone of contention between landlord and tenants' rights groups, and with landlords saying strict rent control laws limit housing stock and tenants saying a lack of rent control actually makes that housing stock unaffordable. The new law would repeal that act. How likely is it to pass? And if it does, how will California and the Bay's rental market react to this change in the law? Well, joining me to talk about it is State Assemblymember Ron Bonta. He's one of the lead leaders of Assembly Bill 1506. Welcome, Rob Bonta.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Honored to be here with you.
Good to have you. Also joining me now to debate this legislation is Dean Preston. He's Executive Director of Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Deborah Carlton, who joins us this morning, Senior Vice President for Public Affairs for the California Apartment Association, and welcome, Deborah Carlton.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thanks to all of you for being here. Let me begin with Assemblymember Bonta. This is actually can be summed up in one line, repeal the state limits on rent control laws. But flesh it out for a little bit more for us, if you could, Assemblymember.
Michael, it asks for repeal of Costa-Hawkins. And what Costa-Hawkins is a one-size-fits-all blanket prohibition against even considering anywhere in the state rent stabilization for certain categories of housing, and that is for new construction, which is defined as units that are built after 1995 or earlier if a local jurisdiction implemented rent control before then, or for single-family homes or condos. It also prohibits everywhere in the state any consideration of rent stabilization after a vacancy of a unit. So the repeal would simply, it would mandate nothing. It would implement, it would not implement rent control or rent stabilization anywhere in the state, but what it would do is return local control to local jurisdictions, to leaders who are on the ground, who see the problems facing their community members, who can then craft policy and narrowly tailor solutions to the housing problems as they see them. And we are in a state of crisis, a state of emergency. It's all hands on deck. When we're in emergencies and in states of crises, we know that we must have all options on the table. We must have all tools in the toolbox. And last year, we did quite a bit on increasing supply. We provided more funding to fund increased supply of housing throughout the state of California through a bond, through a dedicated source of funding in the form of a recording fee. We implemented some streamlining rules to make it easier to build. And this is a two-step process, a dual-track process. While we build more housing, we also need to protect tenants where they are. And no one knows better how to do that than locals. And the problems are different in different jurisdictions throughout the state. And I think that this blanket prohibition should be removed so that local leaders can step up and stand up for their vulnerable community members, which include seniors, the ill, our immigrants, those with disabilities, the poor, who are very housing unstable. And Costa-Hawkins would be repeal would be an important first step.
Well, you've said that this would go to local jurisdictions, and there are some who would say, who have said, or on record as saying, it might be better to have something statewide. And I mention that only because this bill was sponsored by not only you, but David Chu and Richard Bloom. And Richard Bloom has said, we're open to listening to good alternative suggestions.
We are, and we have to be. You know, this is a starting point that we believe is appropriate. We know that the legislative process is multi-step and multifaceted, and stakeholders will all be at the table. They're invited to be there to participate and provide input and good ideas to get us to a place that is best for tenants and for Californians. And I think by lifting this blanket prohibition, this statewide bar, it allows the conversation to continue in local jurisdictions throughout the state, and that's important because when the problems are different, they might need different solutions. And this allows for solutions that are crafted and tailored to the problems as they exist in local jurisdictions throughout the state of California.
We've got Assemblymember Rob Bonta on the line. He's with the 18th District, which includes Oakland, Alameda, and San Leandro, and is co-author of SB 1506, which would essentially repeal Costa-Hawkins. Wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way things are going and the trajectory here, Assemblyman. It's going to be heard by a committee tomorrow, and then it would presumably go to the full assembly. Failing passage by full assembly, you're going to need about 385,000 signatures or so to get it on the ballot?
Yeah, we're at the beginning of the legislative process with AB 1506, as you mentioned, being heard in Assembly Housing Committee, chaired by Assemblymember David Chu. One of the co-authors, and it's the first step. And frankly, Michael, traditionally, historically, just looking back at what's actually occurred, bills that seek to amend Costa-Hawkins or another law in California called the Ellis Act have been very difficult to move out of the first house and the first committee. So we're hoping that we can do something unprecedented tomorrow and move this bill out. I think it's going to be a heavy lift. It always has been, but it's the right thing to be doing, and it's an important push. And I know that we're going to have quite a few Californians who are hurting, who know that repeal of Costa-Hawkins can help provide stabilization in their housing situations. That will be there to provide their voice, and I'm looking forward to having that conversation tomorrow. But if we get past Housing Committee tomorrow, there's still a number of steps to get past Assembly floor and then back over to the other house and onto the governor's desk. So we're far from getting this bill passed and signed. And if it doesn't, there is, as you mentioned, a proposition that's in the works to also repeal Costa-Hawkins. Signatures are being gathered. You're right, tens of thousands of signatures need to be gathered. I think that process is going well, and we'll see how it all shakes out. But both the legislative and proposition paths are being pursued aggressively, and they're both moving.
Assemblymember Bonta, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
It's Assemblymember Rob Bonta, one of the co-sponsors of the bill that we've been talking about and are going to continue to talk about, SB 1506. I'd introduce Deborah Carlton and Dean Preston. Dean Preston's here with us in studio. He's executive director of Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. Are we talking about more protection from displacement? And maybe more importantly, are we talking about more housing as a result of this?
Well, we're definitely talking about
more affordable housing.
We're definitely talking about more affordable housing if Costa-Hawkins is lifted and cities can actually provide greater protections to their tenants. And we are also talking about less displacement and homelessness and folks leaving the state. I mean, we've lost nearly a million low-income Californians from since 2000 who are unable to afford to continue living in California. So we've got about 45% of the state are renters, nearly 17 million tenants in California. Millions of them are protected by rent control. Most of them are not. And we've had this really irrational approach of allowing the state to categorically preempt cities from adopting protections that some cities might want to adopt. And as Assemblymember Bonta pointed out, Costa-Hawkins repeal does not enact rent control for a single unit or change rent control for a single unit. It simply unties the hands of cities. And where there is the local political will and the local market conditions and need, and where cities are experiencing such high rents and displacement, they can finally, at long last, act more robustly. They can impose rent control on units that have been exempt if they choose to do that. But it's important to understand that even before Costa-Hawkins, many cities had that power and didn't use it. For example, there were very few cities that imposed what's called vacancy control, which is actually regulating the price of the unit even after tenants move and new tenants move in. Vacancy control is very effective in the cities that had it in slowing the rising rents and in providing affordable housing.
Let me ask you, though, since you mentioned cities that have had success, the same law pretty much was passed in New York City. Thousands of units were abandoned across the city. Owners said that they couldn't maintain them. They couldn't maintain them, period.
Well, are you talking about vacancy control?
Yeah.
Well, in New York City, I think the analysis, New York City continues to have rent control. They did do decontrol. The city's looking at cities that have adopted. We have an example in California. We had 5 cities that had vacancy control. There was no widespread abandonment. We're experiencing that actually now under Costa-Hawkins of units that are being converted to other uses. So I understand, you know, generally in most of these debates, the industry pins any non-use of property on rent control when in fact...
Actually, some of the studies like the one at Stanford have also... pretty much highlighted what you just said about rent control. In other words, all the data on rent control doesn't necessarily mean more housing or less vacancy. But let me hear from Deborah Carlton on this, because that's the argument we hear from your side, that if you increase rent control restrictions, there's going to be more vacant units and more housing shortage. How does that work in your mind?
You're absolutely right. I think, and first let me state, we do agree there's a huge problem. You know, we have about 1.5 million low-income families, they lack access to affordable housing. You know, I can relate to that. You know, I have kids in college, and because of low vacancy rates, there's going to be no place for them to live. We argue that rent control, extreme forms of rent control, and we're talking about rent control that wouldn't allow vacancy control or vacancy decontrol, would put rent control on single-family homes and condominiums, for example. We believe that all the work we've done in the past couple of years to try to encourage new housing construction will come to a halt if extreme forms of rent control are passed in our cities. And I say extreme rent control because, you know, we do have rent control in our cities, but we do have the protections of Costa-Hawkins. So we would disagree. We also think that it's a strong NIMBY, kind of a not-in-my-backyard tool for individuals who do not want to see housing development. In fact, one of the same proponents of the measure sponsored a local ballot measure last year in Los Angeles to stop all housing construction in the city. That's just not going to solve our problem.
Get a response from you on this, if I could, Dean Preston, and we'll go back to you in a moment, Deborah. Go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, absolutely, because this is one of the industry talking points against rent control as well as against repealing Costa-Hawkins. They regularly say that new construction will come to a halt. And, you know, the problem with that is twofold. First of all, the discussion should happen at the local level, and people can make their arguments about that market and what the impact of rent control would be. But more importantly, that is one of these points that saying it over and over again does not make it true. Then the data actually suggests the opposite. So if you look for...
What data are you talking about?
So if you look at two sets of data. So if you look at the studies in the Bay Area of rent control cities versus non-rent control cities, rent control cities outbuild non-rent control cities. And the Urban Displacement Project at UC and other studies have established that's just census data. Okay. And secondly, even if you look at the pre Costa-Hawkins period, in which there was vacancy control, those jurisdictions did not suffer from a lack of construction. So where is this idea coming from? It is coming from industry talking points, not from data, that rent control or that repealing Costa-Hawkins would in any way inhibit construction. That the fact is what drives construction is not whether there's rent control or not. What drives construction, it's an important point, is the factors like materials, cost of materials, zoning laws, interest rates. That's what drives whether builders build, not whether there's rent control.
Let me go back, though, to Deborah Carlton and ask you, Deborah Carlton, how has the state benefited from Costa-Hawkins?
Well, the state has benefited because of the no new controls on new construction, right? That's a huge factor. And I would strongly disagree with Dean's point we've already hearing from developers that they're going to put their projects and are already putting their projects on hold because they don't know what's going to happen with this bill or with the state initiative. And some of these projects have been in the works for years because one of our biggest problems in some cities, even without rent control, is the inability to move housing construction through the process, right? So we're going to continue to see developers. They've already told us we're putting our projects on hold until we know, because it has to be predictable. And the unpredictable nature of local regulations, specifically rent control, is what drives housing construction.
Let me get your response to a comment that's come in from Ian here. Excuse me, says, I raised my two kids in a single-family San Francisco home rental with reasonable rent hikes. Then my landlords found out about Costa-Hawkins and raised the rent 35% overnight. Repealing Costa-Hawkins is the only way to avoid them raising it another 50, 100, 200% they want. This repeal could be my family's last chance to remain in the city. And you say what to that, Deborah Carson?
I do agree. We do have big concerns about the way in which housing prices are increasing. But we argue it's because the lack of enough vacancy, the lack of other housing, the lack of competition, because especially in rent control jurisdictions, you're not seeing enough housing being produced. Sure, that we will see, and everyone will say there's plenty of cranes in the air, housing is being built, but that is housing that's being and has been in the works for sometimes a decade. And everything that is and has been in the works is now coming to fruition, but nothing new will we see going forward.
All right, we're coming up on a break, and I want to give out the phone number. A lot of people want to get involved in this conversation, and if you want to be one of them, you can join us at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, you can join the program at that number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. As we come up on the break here, Dean Preston, let me read another comment. Why is this conversation stuck on one extreme or the other? Why not reform Costa-Hawkins to a cap the amount that rent can increase, or change the new buildings clause to anything built in the last 20 years rather than anything built after 1995. Seems like this would incentivize new buildings and stabilize housing stock. I wanted to read that because we heard Assemblyman Bonta say, yeah, there's possibility of change with this bill, and this bill is open to discussion. I mean, it's going to be discussed tomorrow. Has some flexibility along those lines?
Well, I think that the flexibility is at the local level. I mean, I think it's important to understand that this is not a bill that, if this were a bill that mandated rent control on new construction, for example, then it might be appropriate in the state legislature to say, well, what are we going to apply that to, and to have that discussion. But that's not what it does. All this does is say this discussion can happen locally, and that's why full repeal is appropriate, so that local jurisdictions can craft their own policies.
All right, well, we'll hear what you have to say when we return here. And again, remind you that we're talking with Dean Preston. He's executive director of Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights, and Deborah Carlton, who is senior vice president public affairs for the California Apartment Association. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A bill to repeal Costa-Hawkins is getting a public hearing tomorrow, and we're getting a public hearing from you, our public, our listeners, in terms of your thoughts about this or any questions or comments you might have. And you are indeed welcome to join the program. We invite you to join us either by phone at 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Spoke earlier with Assembly Rob Bonta, who is one of the sponsors of this bill. It's SB 1506. And with us in studio is Dean Preston from the Tenants Together Group. And Deborah Carlton's with us also from the California Apartment Association. Let me go right to your phone calls, and let's begin with the caller from San Francisco. Natalie, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I'm so excited to hear about this. I actually learned really recently about Costa-Hawkins because I had to. My landlord attempted to, or did, raise our rent by 70% all in one go. There were three of us, me and my roommates, living there, and we would have each had to pay double what we were paying all at once, which effectively was evicting us, like she knew that we couldn't afford that. And then come to find out, a few months later, she's just selling the home for over $1 million. So it is one of those things where I feel like at the local level, I think especially in San Francisco, this could be a really helpful repeal. But I did want to ask, because it does sort of sound like this is a deregulation at a certain level. Are there political leanings behind the arguments on either side of this bill, and what are they? How are the positions being articulated?
All right, let me go first to get a response from Deborah Carlton about your concern about a 70% raise in rent, and that isn't necessarily unusual. Deborah Carlton, people can't afford those kind of raises. If jurisdiction says locally shouldn't have them anymore, they're protected.
Yeah, you know, I agree. Again, we're very concerned about the rising rents. And again, unfortunately, there's no ability, I think, to compromise when it comes to 1506, because, of course, we do have the initiative that's going forward. I think the most unfortunate thing about the deregulation, if you will, if a local government, and many will, because they did back in the 70s, put rent control on single-family homes, and that may be what your caller is renting, the owners will simply sell those units, and that's what sounds like what's happening here. Like we saw in New York, they just get out of the business. It's just not worth it. And because of the individual, especially in the Bay Area now, that can afford to buy these homes, I think we're going to see a mass exodus in the single-family home market. People will sell them.
Dean Preston, you want to say anything about deregulation and the political forces behind this that the caller raised?
Well, sure. And just to briefly, though, the rent increases, I think it's really important to sometimes to get beyond all the policy speak and look at the what people are experiencing. I mean, Deb may be concerned about a 70% rent increase, but she's standing in the way of any policy that would actually prevent a landlord from charging a 70% rent increase. And the reality in California, and people are often shocked to realize this, is if you are not in a rent-controlled home, that the landlord can raise your rent 100% for no reason. And that we run a statewide hotline. We get calls all the time. We just talked to someone the other day, 117% rent increase in a property they're renting in Richmond that's exempt from rent control. So this really is about whether cities should be able to control those kind of increases and prevent them or not. On the issue of deregulation, I mean, Costa-Hawkins itself was deregulation. Costa-Hawkins is the source of deregulation, and we're trying to get rid of that. And it absolutely is the caller's question around like the kind of politics behind it. I think the elephant in the room on any of these discussions is that Deb's organization, as well as the California Association of Realtors, are heavyweights in Sacramento, and it's very difficult to have a reasoned policy discussion and a discussion of the impacts that the tenants are experiencing when the reality is that the landlord and real estate industry spends a huge amount of money on political candidates and shapes the debate and really controls legislation too often in the Capitol. And that's what we're up against. So we're hoping for a massive turnout to push back against
that
tomorrow.
Could I get some pushback from you on that, Deborah Carlton? Your thoughts about what Dean Preston just described as perhaps, shall we say, the disproportionate amount of influence by those who represent landlords and property owners?
Well, you know, certainly I won't disagree with the fact that rental property owners do work very hard to influence the votes, as do tenants at the local level. San Francisco, with 60% to 70% of the tenant population, far outnumber certainly landlords in that city. And that's, of course, why we very much understand that when the decision goes back to the local government, there will be extreme forms of rent control, because politicians at the local level, even if they disagree with the extreme forms of rent control, will be pressured by tenant organizations. And Dean Preston's group is very good at what they do to make sure that tenants are aware. With social media today, they can easily bring tenants to bear on the local government level. And that's why we saw so many local jurisdictions impose rent control over the last 2 years.
Well, I'm getting some anti-rent control remarks here from listeners. Let me read them, and you can add your own voice here by emailing us forum at kqed.org or going right to our Website, kqed.org/forum. Saar writes, rent control is an absolute nightmare that causes blights, limits the supply of housing, and skews the market. We must stop rent control and ban it in the city. Rick writes, rent control will discourage landlords from creating or maintaining rental units. Why do people still believe that they can steal private property rights? Let me get another caller on here, and that's Martin from Santa Clara. Martin, join us.
Hi. I'm a mom-and-pop landlord in Santa Clara, and I risked everything I had to buy a fourplex in 2000. People think that rent goes up all the time. I had to survive a recession where my rents went down 24%. With rent control, that would have taken maybe more than a decade to recover from. The main thing about Costa-Hawkins is even though I'm under rent control, when things go vacant, I can go back to the market. I really need that ability to go back to market when people leave.
Okay, I thank you for that comment. In fact, as I understand it, this Senate bill not only it does something about market here that changes things by repealing Costa-Hawkins. Can you outline that for us, Dean Preston or Deborah Carlton, whomever wants to jump in here first?
I think what he's talking about is vacancy decontrol.
Right.
So if you've had a tenant that's been there for 20 years, which is not unusual. I mean, in New York, we see tenants paying 1946 type rent, right? That you can move your rent to market rate once that tenant moves out. But when the tenants are living there in a rent controlled jurisdiction, the local rent control boards control what rent can be charged. And then, again, when the tenant moves out, the landlord has the opportunity to move the rent to the market rate, which is certainly a fair, I think, opportunity when you've had tenants that have lived there for decades.
Well, that's part of Costa-Hawkins, too.
That's correct.
Yeah. And you want to comment on that, Dean Preston?
Yeah. Before Costa-Hawkins, five of the 12 cities that had rent control at that time did pass vacancy control, and it varied by jurisdiction. And the discussion of how much of an increase should there be when there's a change of tenancy, or as the caller asks, whether there should be some baseline that if the rents go down, it comes back to that. Those could all be discussed in shaping a local policy. But I did want to point out one side of the vacancy decontrol that is mandated by Costa-Hawkins. In other words, the market rent being unlimited at the time a unit is first rented, is that it's created an incredible incentive for harassment and displacement of long-term tenants. And so when you have a tenant who's in their home and they've been there 10 years and their rent is below market, because there's no limit whatsoever on what the landlord can charge if they get that tenant out, it has this perverse effect of incentivizing displacement.
Can I get you to comment on that, Deborah Carlton? This is going on. You know, I hear stories anecdotally, but you know, people who are driven out by their landlords because their landlords want to avoid rent control.
Well, I think that's, quite frankly, the exception. It's not the norm. And, of course, it's illegal. And tenants certainly have the opportunity to.
But let's face it, there are ways to do that within the legal boundaries. I mean,
that's exactly
the anecdotal stuff I hear, yeah.
Yeah, and we certainly do not support that and would work to ensure that that doesn't happen. And we have done that certainly at the state level and at the local level as well.
Well, let me bring some more callers on here. I thank the last caller and go right to Dave in San Francisco. Join us.
Yeah, hi. I'm an architect, and I work with both very wealthy people, some of whom are my friends, and I work with people who perhaps are not so wealthy. But I rent a house in Noe Valley, and it's $5,000 a month. And it was our absent landlord raised the rent from $2,500 to $5,000 in 1 year. And to contradict some of your landlord callers, he's done nothing to the house. We have very little, and it's not like we have the money to sue people. So I would say my wealthy clients, who are wonderful people, need regulation. And regulation's complicated. So some of that regulation is going to be rent control, definitely. I think it should be 100% rent control. And other aspects of the regulations have to do with making it more nuanced to answer some of the concerns.
David, it sounds like you're in a wind tunnel, I'm sorry to say, but I appreciate your comments. Let me let them stand because we'll get as many calls on as we can here. This is obviously a topic that's fraught with all kinds of controversy. Let me go to Reed next. Reed, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm an SF developer, and we basically rehab old rent control buildings. And the concern I have is if we repeal Costa Hawkins and potentially fix what we can adjust the rent to when units are vacant, that it essentially turns us into a utility, and there's no incentive to put any money into our buildings. And how do you mitigate that?
How do you mitigate that, Dean Preston?
Well, I think the problem is first to challenge that, because before rent control passed, these exact arguments are used. Nobody's going to invest in their property. Rent control is going to destroy the housing stock. They were going to have blighted neighbors. None of it turned out to be true. And at a certain point, when you start hearing the same arguments getting recycled, of course, a developer will make more money if they can go to market. The discussion at the local level, if San Francisco would even decide to pass vacancy control, which it didn't when before, it was vetoed by Mayor Feinstein, it never became law. But if things changed and San Francisco decided to pass vacancy control, they could talk about what is a reasonable bump up at the time that a unit is vacant that doesn't incentivize harassment and displacement of long-term tenants, but does provide a reasonable return. And all of this is overlaid by court decisions going back to the 70s that establish a landlord's right of fair return in the property. And that is incorporated in every rent control law. So the use of the term extreme rent control as if it's somehow going to deprive a landlord of a right to a fair return on their property, that kind of law, if it was so extreme, would be thrown out by the courts.
I'm looking at a comment from a listener who tweets, this all boils down to income inequality. And what about what Dean Preston just presented, Deborah Carlton, to you?
Well, I think it's just so unpredictable. Again, we do disagree that there have been continual development under rent control. It just hasn't happened. We've seen neighborhoods, blighted neighborhoods, and the most unfortunate part about rent control, that studies have shown us that while it seeks to help low-income tenants, it really does help high-income earners, because they have the ability still, landlords, to choose who's coming into their units. And it's not something that helps low-income tenants. You know, households looking to move to California are going to continue to face stiff competition from limited housing, making it difficult for them to secure that housing. So even the state's legislative analyst has confirmed that rent control would benefit the more affluent renters.
And again, Deborah Carlton is Senior Vice President of Public Affairs for the California Apartment Association. Some comments coming in. Let me read a couple of them. Mo writes, the focus for rent control should be on landlords, who are the big guys in the business. It is inappropriate to encumber the little guys and gals who bought one or two rentals as a hedge for retirement or college for their kids. And Steve writes, we need more housing, not more regulations. More regulation leads to gentrification and income inequality. And here's another caller, James from Dublin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what do the landlords have at stake here? Like, it seems to me that on one side of the argument, you have renters who need affordable housing or, you know, potentially face, you know, having to leave the state. And on the other side, it seems like they just potentially aren't making quite as much profit as they could be. Like, that seems really lopsided to me.
Deborah,
and I'll take my answer off the
air. All right. Thank you for the question. Deborah Carlton, let me go to you.
Well, I think the bottom line, it still comes back to competition in the marketplace. If there's not enough vacancy or not enough places for people to live, you end up with what we're seeing in some cities where landlords, fortunately or unfortunately, can charge rates that only the wealthy can afford. And I think that's most unfortunate, because we just don't think that rent control is going to help solve that issue, because, of course, the wealthy will still have access to these rent-controlled units, and it's still going to push out a low-income earners, forcing them out or further away from their jobs.
All right. Do you want to comment from that, Dean Preston?
I do. There's part of the problem right now is that there is no relationship between the landlord's costs and what they can charge. And so when your caller asks what do landlords have at stake, the honest answer is just the extent of their profits. It's not whether they can earn profits. Those that they get a fair return under any rent control law. And the reality, we had a caller earlier who talked about his rent going from $2,500 to $5,000. There's no conceivable way that that the landlord's costs drove that decision. Their property taxes haven't gone up because of Prop 13. There's no cost imaginable that has led to that. What has led to that is an increased demand that allows them to get that out of their tenant. And the question is, are we going to regulate that and control that in any way? Because tenants do have something at stake. They are losing their income and they're losing their homes.
And we go to more of your calls. Let's go to San Jose. Joshua, join us. You're on the air.
Well, thank you and good morning. I've been involved in a lot of the rent control campaigns here in the Bay Area for the past 18 months, and I think it's important to note that in five Bay Area cities in the past year, rent control was overwhelmingly rejected by the voters. It's also important to note that every time that property owners, their representatives, and tenant advocates sit down, it's impossible to have a reasoned discussion because the tenant advocates and Mr. Preston's group have taken the position of rent control or bust. Whenever property owners offer relocation assistance, long-term lease agreements, or even guarantees to put low-income residents in rent-controlled units, they say no. And they say no because they want to make sure that they get rent control and they refuse to negotiate. The voters have seen through that. They've rejected rent control, and they've also rejected the cost. These programs cost over $2.5 million a year. We're now seeing in Mountain View that it's costing parks, libraries, and open space to the tune of $1 million a year. And quite frankly, there are better ways to spend that money, and I'd like to hear from Mr. Preston and his group on solutions other than rent control because they've been rejected so many times by the voters and city councils.
Well, he makes some salient points here in Preston about the votes, which is accurate, and about cost and, well, political negotiations not being done. What do you say?
Well, the cost argument is not accurate. The money for rent control programs comes from a per-unit fee on landlords. Not a penny of money in most rent control jurisdictions comes from the general fund. So the idea that parks money, libraries money is being used to fund a rent control program is not accurate. This is actually, and one of the benefits of rent control, this is from the perspective of the government funds, is a cost-neutral program, in contrast to building affordable housing, which we all support, but which is quite expensive. But passing a rent control law is free, and then the program is funded by a small fee.
Well, he asked, where else would you go, for example, for compromise?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, on the point of voters rejecting rent control, you know, it is important to realize that it highlights the fact that the landlords are fully capable of fighting these battles locally. We've won some and passed rent control, and the landlords have won some and defeated them, and that's where the discussion should happen. On compromise, there are a lot of different programs that protect tenants that we are supportive of, routine inspection programs to improve the quality of housing stock for people, right to counsel legislation to make sure tenants have equal access to the courts. There are many types of legislation. We don't solely focus on rent control, but I will acknowledge we do believe that it is fundamentally wrong for any tenant to have their rent doubled. That should not be allowed, and we should be really discussing what type of rent control we want for in different communities, not whether anyone should be subject to unlimited increases.
Let me go back to you, Deborah Carlton, and hear what you have to say on this, please.
Well, I obviously agree with your caller. I think, again, you're going to hear me probably repeat continually that the solution is not going to be more regulation. Even again, in areas in which we've seen no construction, that's where we're seeing rents increase because of the lack of places for people to live. You can't continue to build your business base and bring in new business and not match it with housing. We have a huge housing imbalance when it comes to the number of businesses that we are providing, and rent control won't solve that. It will simply, of course, help existing tenants in place at that moment. But thereafter, no one coming to California or moving to the area to try to find a job or kids coming out of college are going to be able to find a place to live. And again, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Preston that this will stop housing construction or slow it to a trickle. And I think that's where the problem lies for the future citizens in California.
All right, let me read a couple more listener comments. Eric writes, It's critical that the state maintain control of the whole housing market. If San Francisco develops a tenant-focused housing market, then this sector of the state will not thrive and grow. Local control only encourages NIMBYism. And Seth writes, isn't it wonderful to play Monopoly with people's lives? Private property notwithstanding, rental units where people live should be classified as public utility. Public needs should trump greed. And let me bring some more of our callers on. And let's go next to Oakland. And we welcome, I think I'm pronouncing your name right, Omiwale?
It's Omiwale, and I'm from Berkeley. But I'm having
some
difficulty with the comments that are being made. First of all, the greed of removing and displacement is horrendously large. And the people who are being displaced do not have a voice so that they're situations are being known to the public as often as they should be. So I think the lady's comment about the use of Costa Hawkins to remove and displace people is an exception is totally erroneous and ridiculous. We have friends right now who are fighting to stay in their units. They've been there for years. The greed of the real estate market, because the prices have gone up and are allowing landlords to over supply themselves with profit, has caused them to create all kinds of excuses to get older tenants out. They have victimized veterans. They've victimized disabled. They have victimized people with families, young children. They've victimized people over 60. And it's not an exception. It is a rule. It is becoming something that is extremely an epidemic, I would call it, an epidemic of removing people. Voters rejected, may have rejected rent control, but I think if you look at when those votes came down and the percentage of the people who voted and the amount of information about the propositions that were being voted upon, you'll find out that the people who are being evicted now didn't have accurate or clear information about that at the time and didn't know that they should have voted. It was an off year, and so those who voted consistently were more conservative than those who were being now thrown out of their homes. Finally, I just wanted to mention there's a rollover of this rent increase and this gouging of prices that's affecting nursing home applicants, people who have relatives who need to go into nursing homes in the Oakland, Berkeley area, are not able to afford the monthly rent for their care for assisted living and also for those who need more medical care, because the nursing homes are taking advantage of this uptake and this 100% increase in rents. And so people are now being forced to send their relatives way outside the Alameda County area or close to where they live so that relatives and friends can continue to nurture and take care of these people. So Costa Hawkins, it needs to be repealed immediately. Yes, there needs to be some sort of balance, but right now tenants are being gouged and victimized and unfairly taken advantage of, and Costa Hawkins is really costing people dearly.
All right, let me have it stand there, and thank you for your call. A number of points you've made, and we can get some responses. But actually, in a broader sense, I'm looking at a comment from a listener named Lydia, and I'd like to go to you on this, Deborah Carlton. She says, how do we prevent high-income earners from living in rent-controlled housing? A number of listeners have been asking about income-based rent control, for example.
Yeah, well, I think that's the point I made earlier, that rent control today and in the future, if it were to become more of an extreme form, is not means tested, meaning it doesn't discriminate against anybody based upon how much income they make. And that's one of the biggest problems with the discussion that we're having and have had, is that individuals, of course, will not be protected from an extreme form of control, low-income individuals specifically.
Would you be in favor of means testing?
We certainly
your organization?
we certainly have introduced that issue into the conversation and have asked that that be part of the conversation. But again, that's not what AB 1506, the bill that will be up tomorrow, or the state initiative is about. It doesn't allow for that kind of conversation.
Okay, and we've had quite a full conversation here. Let me read one more comment from Sue, who says, I live in a 15-unit building with 7 empty units, some of which have been empty for years next door. There are 2 to 3 empty units that have been empty for a decade. We need a vacancy tax. And Pamela tweets, Costin Hawkins does not impose rent control. It only allows municipalities to decide what renter protections work for their areas. So we will continue to follow this story, and it is an important one. I'm sorry we couldn't get a lot of you who are waiting on the air on with us, but let me thank our guests. Thanks, first of all, to Assemblymember Rob Bonta, one of the sponsors of SB 1506, who joined us early in the program. Thank you, Dean Preston. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for covering this.
Dean Preston, again, is Executive Director of Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. And thanks, Deborah Carlton. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Deborah Carlton, again, is Senior Vice President of Public Affairs with the California Apartment Association. And when we return, well, we're going to talk with Dick Cavett in the first half hour of the program coming up. And in the bottom half of the hour, we spoke with the Attorney General earlier in this hour. We're going to talk more about what is in line for DACA, and stay tuned for that as well. It's coming up in the hour ahead. And thank you for being with us this first hour of Forum. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.